Long before the word Africa was etched into maps, there was Alcabulan, a name believed to mean Mother of Mankind or Garden of Eden. It was spoken in ancient tongues and whispered through generations by civilizations whose wisdom predated colonial empires. To some, it was a land of divine order and spiritual power. To others, the cradle of humanity itself. But over time, this name was buried under conquest, rewritten by Greek and Roman scholars, and finally replaced by colonial cartographers. What was lost wasn't just a name, but an entire worldview, a memory of identity, of pride, of place. Now, a new generation is unearthing what was almost erased. They're asking, what was Alcabulan? Who named it, and why was that name taken away? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Origins of a Name. Before maps had borders, before nations had flags, and before the continent we now call Africa had a single name, there was Alcabulan. It is a word cloaked in mystery. Depending on whom you ask, it has various meanings. Mother of Mankind, Land of the Blacks, or Garden of Eden. Some claim it has Arabic roots, possibly from Alcabulan or Bilad al-Sudan, while others insist it predates Arabic altogether, spoken by indigenous peoples of the Nile Valley and Sahel. What's indisputable is this. Before Africa was Africa, the continent was known by many other names, depending on time, place, and people. To the ancient Egyptians, it was Tameri, the beloved land. To the Berbers, Ifriqiya, the land of caves. And to many early scholars and philosophers, especially those tracing the spiritual and linguistic roots of black civilizations, the name Alcabulan stood as a symbol of cultural integrity and ancestral memory. The power of a name. Names hold meaning. They tell you where you come from, who you belong to, and how you see the world. When the Roman Empire expanded into the northern regions of the continent, they labeled the land Africa, derived from the Latin Afri, used to describe a tribe in what is now Tunisia. To the Romans, this was a geographical marker. But over centuries, the name was broadened, eventually swallowing the entire continent in its grasp. This rebranding was more than linguistic. It marked the beginning of an erasure. Alcabulan didn't just vanish, it was suppressed, forgotten not by chance, but by force. Language became a weapon of empire. Arabic, Latin, and later English, French, and Portuguese names replaced native terms. Entire systems of knowledge, spiritual, cultural, geographical, were renamed or removed. Ancient civilizations, ancient words. If we dig deeper, the story grows more fascinating. Civilizations like Nubia, Aksum, Carthage, and Mali each had their own names for the land and its people. In early Christian writings, the land south of Egypt were sometimes called Ethiopia, a Greek term meaning burnt faces, used broadly to describe black people. But this label too came from outsiders. The Moors, black African Muslims who ruled parts of Spain for centuries, are often associated with preserving some of the earliest versions of the name Alcabulan. To them, the name represented divine wisdom and ancestral sovereignty. In oral traditions still passed down in parts of West and East Africa, stories reference a vast ancient land, a motherland rich in spirit and nature, whose name has echoed through time, even if the written records have faded. The scholars who reawakened Alcabulan. In the 20th century, as Pan-African consciousness grew stronger A handful of African scholars began asking a provocative question. What if the name Africa itself was a colonial construction? What if reclaiming our identity started with reclaiming our name? One of the most prominent voices in this movement was Senegalese historian Cheikh Anta Diop. A physicist by training, Diop argued that the roots of African civilization stretched back not only through Egypt and Kush, but into the shared DNA of modern African people. To him, names mattered. If Egypt was African, and Africa was the cradle of civilization, then why were Africans using foreign names to describe themselves? Around the same time, Guyanese historian Ivan van Sertema brought new light to African influence on the ancient world, particularly in pre-Columbian Americas and the Mediterranean. He too saw the renaming of African lands as part of a broader colonial amnesia. Alcabulan became more than a word. It became a symbol of resistance. A forgotten word reemerges. Still, Alcabulan remains controversial. Critics argue that the term lacks direct linguistic evidence in pre-colonial manuscripts. Some say it's a romanticized reconstruction, more Afrocentric vision than historical fact. But others argue that the written record has never told the full story. They point to oral traditions, to buried stone tablets, to the wisdom of elders who've kept the stories alive when everything else was stolen. In Harlem, Nairobi, Johannesburg, and Kingston, the word has been reborn. Not just in books and lectures, but in murals, music, fashion, and film. It appears on protest signs and poetry slams. It's tattooed on arms and stitched into banners at cultural festivals. For many young Africans and diasporic descendants, Alcabulan is more than a word. It is a declaration, a refusal to be defined by the conqueror's vocabulary, a way of saying, we were here long before you named us, and we are still here. A name that shapes a world view. To understand the name, Alcabulan is to understand how names are used to colonize the mind. When you erase a name, you erase the stories attached to it. You delete the ancestors who spoke it. You dissolve the cosmic systems that gave birth to it. But when you remember that name, when you speak it aloud, when you teach it to your children, you begin to reclaim the full scope of who you are. You are no longer a stranger in your own skin. You are the descendant of Alcabulan. Chapter 2. Land and Sacred Geography. To understand a people, you must understand their relationship with the land. And in Alcabulan, the ancient name for Africa, land was never just a resource. It was sacred. It was alive. It was the thread between the heavens and the ancestors. From the highlands of Ethiopia to the deserts of the Sahara, every valley, mountain, river, and tree carried spiritual weight. Geography wasn't just terrain. It was memory, mythology, and meaning. The Nile, vein of civilization. Begin at the Nile, the world's longest river. Its waters cradle a story older than any single nation. The Nile was more than a water source to the civilizations that thrived along its banks. It was a cosmic river, a mirror of the Milky Way. To the Kemites, what we now call the ancient Egyptians, the Nile flowed in harmony with the spiritual order of the universe, known as Maat. Its annual flood was a sacred event, tied not only to survival, but to divine favor. Temples such as Karnak and Luxor weren't randomly placed. They were designed in alignment with the stars and the flow of the river itself. These ancient architects were engineers and astronomers, blending land with sky, form with faith. But even further south, in what is today Sudan, the Nubians built temples and pyramids of their own, many still standing quietly, less visited than those in the north, but no less powerful, The Nile was not just a river. It was a lifeline, a sacred channel through which time and ancestry flowed. Ethiopia, Mountains of Memory. Travel eastward to the rugged highlands of Ethiopia, and you encounter another cradle of civilization. This land is not only home to the fossilized remains of Lucy, one of the oldest hominins ever discovered, but also to one of the longest-running continuous civilizations on Earth. Ethiopia was never colonized in the way much of the rest of Africa was. Its mountains, rising like sacred spires into the clouds, helped shield it from foreign domination. And perhaps because of that, its ancient traditions remain largely intact. Here, geography and spirituality are tightly interwoven. The rock-hewn churches of Lalibela are carved directly into the earth. Pilgrims still climb these mountains barefoot, chanting prayers older than the nations that surround them. According to local lore, these churches were not built by hands alone, but by angels. Whether one believes the legend or not, standing inside the cool, quiet hollows of these stone sanctuaries, it's easy to feel that something sacred dwells there. And not far from here, Lake Tana, source of the Blue Nile, is regarded as a holy body of water, encircled by monasteries that house manuscripts older than many European cathedrals. In Alcabulan, lakes are not just lakes, they are mirrors of the soul. The Sahara, ocean of sand and stars. Now imagine an ocean, not of water, but of sand. The Sahara, once lush and green, is now a vast desert stretching across nearly a third of the continent. And yet, even here, life pulses with meaning. Ancient rock art found in Tassili Nadja, Algeria, reveals a time when the Sahara was home to giraffes, cattle, and rain-fed grasslands. These petroglyphs are not just art, they are archives. They tell us that Alcabulan was once much greener and far more connected than we often assume. Tuareg nomads, known as the Blue People for their indigo garments, still traverse this vast landscape. To them, the desert is not empty. It is alive with spirit and story. The dunes hold echoes of poetry passed from mother to daughter, father to son. Even the stars above play a role. Navigation through the Sahara isn't guided by maps. It's guided by memory, rhythm, and sky. West Africa, Forests of Wisdom. In the west, where the forests thicken and the soil runs deep, lies a different kind of sacred geography. Here, land is home to oracles and shrines, to talking drums and silent groves. Among the Yoruba of modern-day Nigeria, the earth itself is divine. Deities known as Orisha are tied to specific places: rivers, trees, stones. The goddess Osun, for example, is said to dwell in a sacred grove along the Osun River in Osogbo. That grove, protected by dense trees and lined with ancient sculptures, is more than a park. It is a temple without walls. Among the Akan people of Ghana, land inheritance is passed through the mother, because the earth is considered feminine, Asaseya, the earth goddess. To disrespect the land is to insult one's own mother. Even death is grounded in geography. The spirits of the dead return to the earth, joining the ancestors whose bones fertilize the soil. Burials are not final farewells. They are homecomings. The Great Lakes and Mountains of Central Alcabulan. The center of the continent, too often ignored in history books, is a sanctuary of freshwater seas and cloud-draped mountains. The Great Lakes, Victoria, Tanganyika, and Malawi, are some of the deepest and oldest in the world. Mount Kilimanjaro, rising above the plains of Tanzania, was long viewed as a spiritual watchtower. Its snow-capped peak, visible for miles, was believed to be the home of gods or ancestral spirits. Even now, as its glaciers retreat with climate change, it stands like a silent elder watching over the land. Nearby, the Congo rainforest breathes life into the atmosphere. Home to the Bantu-speaking peoples, the forest is both shelter and mystery. The pygmy communities who live here carry oral histories that stretch beyond any written record. The land whispers its own name in wind and birdsong. Those who live close to it have always listened. Southern Africa, stone kingdoms, and desert spirits. In the southern reaches of Alkabulan, the land holds yet more secrets. The Kingdom of Great Zimbabwe, with its massive stone enclosures and soaring conical towers, was once a thriving center of trade, art, and spirituality. Built without mortar, its stone walls have stood for nearly a millennium. For years, colonial historians denied that Africans could have built such structures. But the land tells its truth, and the stones still speak. To the San people of the Kalahari, some of the oldest continuous inhabitants on Earth, the desert is not harsh. It is holy. Their cave paintings are some of the most detailed spiritual artworks on the continent, depicting trance dances, animal spirits, and cosmic visions. The land is not a backdrop. It is the central character in their worldview. To walk across this region is to walk on living myth. The land as teacher. What makes Alkabulan's geography so extraordinary is not just its diversity, but its depth. Each region tells its own story, shaped by its own rhythms, winds, and rituals. And yet, across this vast expanse, one theme remains constant. The land is sacred. It is not conquered. It is not owned. It is communed with. It teaches. It remembers. It forgives. And in a time when much of the world has forgotten its bond with nature, Alkabulan still offers a blueprint for reconnection. In the cracked red clay of a village road, in the soft green of a valley after rain, in the hollow of a tree used as a shrine, there lives a memory of something older than maps, deeper than borders, and more enduring than any empire. It is the memory of a continent, not just alive, but awake. It is Alkabulan. Chapter 3. Art, Sculpture, and Symbolism. If the land of Alkabulan is the body, then its art is the soul. Each carving, mask, and sculpture is more than ornament. It is a vessel of memory, a key to hidden wisdom. For thousands of years, across vast and varied regions, the people of Alkabulan have turned wood, bronze, ivory, clay, and stone into voices, expressing everything from the sacred to the political, from the ancestral to the divine. To truly see Alkabulan, one must look with more than the eyes. One must feel with the spirit. The Benin Bronzes, Empire Cast in Metal. The Kingdom of Benin, located in present-day Nigeria, left behind one of the most remarkable artistic legacies in world history, the Benin Bronzes. Created by master metalworkers over 500 years ago, these plaques and sculptures depict kings, warriors, priests, and mythic scenes in astonishing detail. The artists used the lost wax casting method, a complex technique that allowed for fine lines, layered texture, and rich symbolism. But these bronzes were more than decoration. They recorded royal history. They marked religious rituals. They were spiritual armor, placed in palaces and shrines to remind all who saw them of the sacred power of the Oba, or king. When British soldiers stormed the Benin Kingdom in 1897, they looted thousands of these pieces and scattered them across museums in Europe and America. For over a century, the people of Nigeria have fought to bring them home, not just because of their beauty, but because of what they represent, the silenced voice of a once great civilization. Today, new museums are rising in West Africa to receive them, and with each piece returned, a broken link in Alkabulan's story is restored. If Portraits of the Divine. Just west of Benin lies the ancient Yoruba city of Ife, known for producing naturalistic sculptures that continue to challenge global perceptions of African art. If artists sculpted human heads and figures in terracotta, stone, and bronze, some so lifelike their realism rivals that of Renaissance Europe, these were not random subjects. Each sculpture depicted sacred royalty or divine ancestors believed to carry spiritual energy. The heads, often slightly larger than life, symbolized not ego, but Ori Inu, the inner head, or spiritual consciousness. When Western archaeologists first encountered these pieces in the early 20th century, many couldn't believe they were African-made. Some even speculated wrongly that they must have been influenced by Greeks or Phoenicians. They weren't. They were purely and proudly Yoruba. It reminds us that Alkabulan has always had its own definitions of beauty, proportion, and power, independent of the West. Dogon carvings, echoes of the cosmos. High on the cliffs of Mali, the Dogon people have carved their lives, literally, into stone. Their wooden sculptures depict elongated human forms with raised arms, joined bodies, and stylized limbs. These are not just artistic choices, they are spiritual codes. The figures represent ancestors, celestial beings, and mythic acts of creation. According to Dogon cosmology, the universe began with the vibration of a single word. From that sound came stars, planets, and life. Their myths speak of a star, Sirius B, whose invisible presence they described long before modern astronomy confirmed it. Their architecture, their ritual masks, even the placement of doors and staircases, all reflect cosmic principles. For the Dogon, art is not about self-expression. It is about alignment with the stars, with nature, and with the ancestors. Each carving is a whisper from another world. Nubian and Kemetic symbolism, royal power and the afterlife. Traveling northeast into the lands of ancient Nubia and Kemet, Egypt, we find an entirely different but equally profound visual language. In Kemet, sculpture was a medium of immortality. Pharaohs were carved in stone with stillness and symmetry to reflect Maat, the principle of truth, order, and balance. Statues of gods and kings, even when massive in scale, were created with deep reverence. Every pose had meaning. Every symbol mattered. The Ankh, shaped like a key, symbolized eternal life. The Djed pillar stood for stability. The falcon-headed god Horus, the lioness Sekhmet, the jackal Anubis. Each image told a sacred story of power, sacrifice, and rebirth. Further south, in Nubia, present-day Sudan, rulers built their own pyramids, often smaller but more numerous than those in the north. Statues of the Kushite kings, dark-skinned, broad-nosed with tight curls, stand as proud reminders that civilization didn't flow into Africa from elsewhere. It rose from within. The art of Nubia and Kemet was not separate from life. It was life, eternal and unbroken. Symbols in motion, masks and performance. In many parts of Alkabulan, art is not meant to be still. It moves, it breathes, it dances. Masks are central to this living tradition. Among the Baul of Côte d'Ivoire, the Dan of Liberia, and the Bwa of Burkina Faso, masks are worn during ceremonies that mark birth, death, harvest, and initiation. The masks represent spirits, animals, ancestors, even forces of nature like wind or disease. Each mask has its own rhythm, its own voice, its own music. When worn, the dancer doesn't just wear the mask, they become the spirit. Through dance, sound, and costume, the community reconnects with the invisible world. And these performances are not theatrical. They are transformative. They heal, they instruct, they protect. In Olkabulan, art is never passive. It calls, it answers, it participates. Symbols of status, gender, and power. In many societies across the continent, personal adornment is also a form of artistic and symbolic expression. Scarification patterns on the face or body can denote one's lineage, marital status, or tribe. Hairstyles, intricate and sculptural, speak of fertility, mourning, or prestige. Beaded necklaces and waist chains carry encoded messages, sometimes known only to initiates or lovers. Among the Maasai of Kenya and Tanzania, vibrant beadwork signals age group, marital status, and social rank. Among the Zulu, colors in beadwork convey specific emotions: white for purity, red for passion, blue for fidelity. Even everyday objects, stools, combs, drums, are carved with such attention to design and meaning that they transcend function. A comb might carry the image of an ancestor. A stool might be a symbol of political authority. In Olkabulan, art is not confined to galleries. It is lived, worn, danced, sung. Diaspora art, remembering through creation. The forced migration of millions of Africans through the transatlantic slave trade scattered Olkabulan's artistic traditions across the globe, but it didn't erase them. In Brazil, Cuba, Haiti, and the American South, echoes of Olkabulan art survive in everything from religious altars to ceremonial dress. The Yoruba Orisha are still venerated through vivid paintings, beadwork, and statues in Candomblé and Santeria traditions. Drums carried in enslaved hands birthed jazz, blues, and hip-hop. In Harlem, murals of black gods and queens reclaim lost narratives. In London and Paris, African diaspora artists remix ancestral aesthetics with modern techniques, creating new languages of resistance and pride. The soul of Olkabulan continues to speak through brush, chisel, rhythm, and word. The revival, reclaiming the narrative. For too long, African art was misunderstood, displayed behind glass without context, labeled as primitive, exoticized for its strangeness. But a shift is underway. Across the continent and in the diaspora, museums are being built, exhibitions are being curated, and young artists are reimagining what it means to create from a place of cultural truth. In Senegal, the Museum of Black Civilizations stands as a proud answer to centuries of erasure. In Lagos, Accra, Nairobi, and Kigali, art fairs now showcase contemporary African brilliance. And at the heart of it all is a single, quiet truth. Art is memory. It remembers what textbooks forgot. It records what colonizers erased. It heals what trauma broke. And it dares to imagine what might come next. Because in Olkabulan, art is not separate from life. It is life. It is ancestor. It is prophecy. Chapter 4. Festivals, food, and storytelling. In Olkabulan, culture is not locked away in ancient tombs or buried beneath ruins. It's alive, in the clang of drums, the aroma of spice, the rhythm of feet in celebration. Festivals, food, and storytelling form a sacred trinity, carrying forward the soul of a continent through memory, movement, and mouth. Where the West separates performance from religion and food from philosophy, Alcabulan binds them all into one, an unbroken celebration of life and legacy. Festivals, dancing through history. Across Alcabulan's vast landscape, festivals are not simply holidays. They are historical reenactments, spiritual rituals, and communal declarations of identity. In Nigeria, the Osun Osogbo Festival draws pilgrims to the Osun Sacred Grove, a UNESCO World Heritage Site where the river goddess Osun is believed to dwell. For 2 weeks, the forest becomes a portal to the divine. The air thickens with incense, and chants echo through the trees. Drummers summon ancient rhythms, while priestesses in white garments offer calabashes of honey, fruit, and prayers to the water's edge. To those who attend, this isn't folklore. It's faith made flesh. In Ghana, Homowo, meaning mocking hunger, is celebrated by the Gar people to commemorate the end of famine. Families cook traditional dishes like kapokpoi, sprinkle it on the ground to feed the ancestors, and then feast in joy. Drumming parades fill the streets. Ancestors are remembered. Hunger is mocked. Life is honored. In Ethiopia, the festival of Timket recreates the baptism of Christ, blending Christian tradition with millennia-old symbolism. During the event, sacred replicas of the Ark of the Covenant are paraded in colorful processions, wrapped in embroidered cloths, followed by thousands dressed in white. Water is sprinkled on the crowd, drums pound, and voices rise in ancient Gaea's hymns. Each festival is unique, yet they share a central truth. Celebration is ceremony. To dance is to remember. To feast is to honor. To gather is to heal. Food. Flavors that speak in generations. In Alcabulan, food is never just food. It's history you can taste. Take injera, the spongy sourdough flatbread of Ethiopia. It's more than a meal. It's a communal act. Families gather around one large tray, sharing stews made from lentils, chickpeas, lamb, or greens. No knives, no forks, only hands, only together. The circular motion of tearing injera and scooping a bite becomes a ritual of closeness and trust. In West Africa, Jollof rice is a cultural battlefield in the most loving way. Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, and others all claim the best version. The dish itself, a rich blend of tomatoes, onions, peppers, and spices cooked into rice, has roots in the ancient Wolof Empire. Today, it fuels weddings, festivals, and weeknight dinners with equal reverence. In the north, tagine simmers slowly in earthen pots across Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria, infused with cinnamon, saffron, olives, and preserved lemon. Every bite tells a story of trade routes and cultural blending, Arab, Berber, Andalusian. And across the Sahel, millet and sorghum are not just grains, they are ancestral memory. They feed the people, feed the livestock, and are offered in shrines during harvest prayers. Food in Alcabulan is passed down not in cookbooks, but in gestures and scent, in repetition and rhythm. Grandmothers whisper techniques, daughters watch, sons stir, the memory is in motion. The return of Alcabulan to the global table. Today, chefs across the diaspora are reviving Alcabulan's food heritage, giving it a new seat at the global table. In Dubai, the Alcabulan Dining Hall, a multi-chef food experience designed by culinary curator Alexander Smalls, has made headlines for celebrating Pan-African cuisine on a world stage. The concept is more than a restaurant. It's a statement. African food is complex, refined, and worthy of celebration. In Harlem, London, Accra, and Johannesburg, new restaurants are redefining what African food can be, whether it's a fine dining interpretation of egusi soup or vegan spins on classic Congolese dishes. The flavors remain ancient, even when the presentation shifts. These spaces are culinary temples, and in every bite, there's a resurrection of something once erased. Storytelling, the eternal flame. Before the written word, before books and scripts, there were griots, the living libraries of Alcabulan. In West Africa, the griot, or jelly, as they're known among the Mande people, was the keeper of history, genealogy, and community memory. With a kora in hand, a stringed instrument somewhere between a harp and a lute, the griot could recite hundreds of years of royal lineage, recount epic battles, or pass on moral tales meant to guide future generations. Their role wasn't casual, it was sacred. Griots were trained from childhood, absorbing stories through song, call and response, and repetition. A community without a griot was a community without memory, and though the role of the griot has evolved, it still thrives in spoken word poetry, in Afrobeat lyrics, in hip-hop, and even in protest chants. From the Ashanti legends of Anansi the Spider to the Ethiopian tales of Arwe the Serpent King, storytelling in Alcabulan has always served a dual purpose, to entertain and to educate. Stories don't end. They cycle. And each telling is a chance to reshape the present. Proverbs, the DNA of wisdom. In every region of Alcabulan, proverbs are the heartbeat of communication. Short, poetic, and layered, they capture the essence of an entire worldview in just a few words. Wisdom is like a baobab tree. No one individual can embrace it. Akan proverb, even the best cooking pot will not produce food. African proverb on action and effort. A child who is not embraced by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. Igbo proverb. These are not mere sayings. They're lifelines. They are how knowledge survives when books are burned or never written. Elders teach through them. Parents discipline with them. Leaders guide by them. Proverbs are carved into the walls of community. Always there, always speaking. Music as living story. In Alcabulan, sound is story. Music isn't background, it's a central narrative force. Drums aren't just instruments, they are languages. The talking drum of the Yoruba can mimic human speech, transmitting praise, news, or warnings across villages. Chants invoke ancestors. Lullabies teach lessons. War songs stir bravery. Funeral dirges invite the dead to rest. Modern African music, from Afrobeats to Amapiano, carries this legacy forward. Even as rhythms evolve, the DNA of Alcabulan's ancient storytelling pulses underneath. Wherever African people have gone, the music has followed. And in that music lives memory. The Festival of Diaspora, a global reawakening. Beyond the borders of the continent, Alcabulan is rising once more in festivals that celebrate the global African family. In Europe, events like the Alcabulan Festival in Amsterdam showcase food, music, art, and workshops rooted in ancestral pride. In the US, Caribbean carnivals, African heritage parades, and Juneteenth celebrations all draw from the same well of cultural memory. These festivals aren't just about fun, they are about reclaiming stolen time, space, and narrative. Each dance move is an echo, each costume a declaration, each shared meal a healing ritual. Whether in Accra or Atlanta, Nairobi or New Orleans, the spirit of Olkabulan gathers the scattered. Not through borders, not through maps, but through rhythm, flavor, and firelight. The Sacred Circle. In Olkabulan tradition, nothing is linear. Time flows in circles. The past lives beside the present, and the future is shaped by how well we remember. Festivals are not just events, they're spiritual resets. Food is not just sustenance, it's a language of love and resistance. Stories are not just entertainment, they are survival. Together, they form the Sacred Circle, a tradition where laughter meets legacy and pleasure meets prayer. So next time you hear a drum, taste a spice, or listen to a story that feels older than your own lifetime, know that you're not just witnessing culture. You're witnessing Olkabulan, alive, evolving, and eternal. Chapter 5. Beliefs and Philosophy. In Olkabulan, belief is not confined to Sunday or mosque, to scripture or steeple. Belief is breath. It's woven into soil, into the wind, into silence and song. To understand the spiritual world of Olkabulan is not just to understand religion. It is to understand how people once saw themselves as part of a living cosmos, balanced between the seen and unseen. This isn't about superstition. It's about systems of thought, sophisticated, ancient, and deeply integrated with the land and life they emerged from. The world was never empty. Across the continent, a central idea appears again and again. The world is not just material. Mountains have memory. Rivers have guardians. Trees speak. The spiritual realm is not a distant kingdom. It lives alongside us, unseen but never absent. To be born in Olkabulan was to be born into relationship with your ancestors, with the spirits of the land, with the sky, with yourself. This relationship wasn't one of domination, but of respect and rhythm. You didn't pray to control nature. You prayed to be in alignment with it. The Kemetic Blueprint, Order, Balance, and the Afterlife. In the northeast corner of the continent, ancient Kemet, what we now call Egypt, built one of the most spiritually advanced civilizations in human history. At the center of Kemetic belief was the concept of Maat, the divine order of truth, justice, balance, and harmony. Maat wasn't just a goddess, it was a way of life. Pharaohs ruled not by brute power, but by their ability to uphold Maat. If they failed, disorder, Isfet, would follow. The afterlife wasn't a vague promise. It was a structured journey. The soul had to pass through trials, be judged by Osiris, and have its heart weighed against the feather of Maat. If your heart was heavy with wrongdoing, it was devoured. If light, you entered Aru, the field of reeds, a spiritual paradise. Temples, rituals, and daily life revolved around this cosmology. To live well was to live in tune with the eternal order. This worldview influenced everything, from science and architecture to medicine and morality. Yoruba cosmology, Orisha and the Web of Life. Further west, among the Yoruba people of present-day Nigeria, belief takes shape in a rich pantheon of deities called Orisha, divine spirits who embody forces of nature, human emotion, and cosmic purpose. There is Obatala, the Orisha of purity and creation, who formed the human body from clay. Shango, the fiery Orisha of thunder and justice. Ocean, goddess of love, beauty, and rivers, known for her charm, but also her depth and ferocity. Each Orisha is not just worshipped, but lived with. A follower might dedicate their life to the Orisha that governs their Ori, their inner head or spiritual essence. Ceremonies include drumming, possession, dance, offerings, and consultation with Babalawos, diviners who interpret the wisdom of the Ifa oracle. The sacred verses of Ifa, passed orally for generations, contain thousands of poetic teachings, guiding everything from farming to family conflict. This isn't simply religion. It's philosophy, psychology, and ecology all at once. Yoruba cosmology teaches that destiny, Ayanmo, is shaped by choice and character. The divine is near. The sacred is practical. Dogon star systems, science wrapped in myth. High in the cliffs of Mali, the Dogon people have preserved one of the most mysterious and fascinating belief systems on Earth. Their cosmology speaks of Nomo, amphibious ancestral beings who descended from the stars. They describe the invisible star Sirius B, long before Western telescopes confirmed its existence. They map the orbits of celestial bodies, tell of twin universes, and chart the spiral path of the Milky Way. Some view these as myths, others as encoded science. But to the Dogon, the story is not either or. It is both myth and knowledge wrapped together, a spiritual understanding of the cosmos that doesn't separate science from story. Their art, architecture, and rituals mirror this cosmic order, each structure and ceremony designed to reflect the balance of heaven and earth. Ancestor veneration, the living dead. In Alcabulan, the dead are not gone. They are transformed. Across many traditions, from the Akan of Ghana to the Shona of Zimbabwe, the ancestors, Nsamanfo, Vadzinza, are honored, fed, spoken to, and consulted. They are seen as guardians who watch over the living and influence daily events. Ancestral altars might include photos, bones, carved figures, or personal items. Libations of water, palm wine, or food are offered regularly. Before major decisions, a person might speak aloud to the spirits of their family, asking for guidance. To forget the ancestors is to become unmoored. To honor them is to remain rooted. This connection is more than nostalgia. It is a moral contract. One's behavior reflects on those who came before and those who will come after. It's accountability wrapped in reverence. In this way, Alcabulanic belief creates an eternal community, stretching backward and forward in time. Nature is not owned, it is honored. One of the most profound aspects of Alcabulan philosophy is the relationship to nature. In traditional belief systems, nature is not inert. Trees have guardians, rivers have moods, mountains house spirits. To build or farm or hunt is to negotiate, not to conquer. Among the Dagara people of Burkina Faso, the earth is considered a living being. Sacred groves are protected not just ecologically, but spiritually. Trees are never cut without ritual. Land is never taken without permission from both human elders and spirit beings. Rainmakers, herbalists, and diviners act as intermediaries between nature and community. Their knowledge is not superstition. It's science embedded in ritual, observation, and respect. In a time when ecological crises threaten the planet, Alcabulan's old philosophies feel urgently new. Healing and energy. Spirituality in Alcabulan is also about healing. Illness is often seen not just as a physical issue, but a spiritual imbalance. Healers, known by many names, Sangomas in southern Africa, Ngangas in central Africa, Babalawos in Yoruba regions, use herbs, ancestral communication, and symbolic rituals to restore balance. Their spaces are sacred, filled with bones, stones, feathers, shells, and smoke. Diagnoses might come through trance, dreams, or casting divination tools like cowrie shells or bones. Healing here is holistic. It addresses the person's spirit, lineage, behavior, and surroundings. These practices, once demonized or dismissed, are now being re-examined by scholars and even some medical professionals. They carry deep insights into psychosomatic wellness, trauma, and community-based care. The Pan-African Spiritual Revival. Today, across Alkabulan and the diaspora, there is a spiritual awakening. People are returning to traditional beliefs, not just as rituals, but as philosophies. In Nigeria and Brazil, Orisha temples are thriving. In South Africa, young people are training as sangomas. In the Caribbean and the US, traditions like Vodun, Candomblé, and Lukumi are shedding the stigma placed upon them by centuries of colonial suppression. Even in academia, there is renewed interest in indigenous African thought systems. Scholars now speak of African metaphysics, Ubuntu philosophy, and communal cosmology, with the respect long reserved for Greek and Roman ideas. This revival is not about going backward. It's about moving forward with roots intact. It's a spiritual reclamation, a healing of identity, a return to balance. Harmony over hierarchy. One thread runs through nearly every Alkabulan belief system. The goal is not to dominate, but to harmonize. Whether it's Ma'at's balance, Ifa's destiny, the Dogon's star paths, or the San people's trance dances, spirituality in Alkabulan seeks unity. Unity between self and spirit. Unity between people and nature. Unity between past, present, and future. This harmony is not utopian. It requires work, ritual, responsibility, reflection. But it is a guiding light passed from elder to child, from shrine to street. And in a world fractured by greed, speed, and isolation, it offers something rare, a path back to wholeness. Chapter 6. Language, Pan-Africanism, and Reclamation. Language is not just a tool for communication. It is the architecture of memory, identity, and worldview. In Alkabulan, languages once stretched like rivers across savannas, deserts, mountains, and islands. Each tongue carried ancestral codes. Each word held history. But colonization cracked that mirror. This chapter explores not just the spoken tongues of Alkabulan, but also the evolving language of freedom, how words like Alkabulan, Pan-Africanism, and reclamation have reemerged to reshape identity across continents and generations. The linguistic wealth of Alkabulan. Before colonization, Alkabulan was home to over 2,000 languages, belonging to more than a dozen language families. These weren't dialects of a single culture. They were distinct worldviews. The Niger-Congo family, one of the largest, spread from west to southern Africa, including Yoruba, Igbo, Wolof, Swahili, Zulu, and Shona. The Afro-Asiatic family covered North Africa and parts of the Horn, languages like Amharic, Hausa, and Tigrinya. The Nilo-Saharan family included Dinka, Luo, and Kanuri. In the south, Khoisan languages featured click consonants found nowhere else on Earth. Each language had its own logic, its own rhythm, tense structure, and philosophy. Many were tonal, meaning that the same word pronounced differently carried different meanings. Some, like the Yoruba word Ori, meant both head and spiritual consciousness. In Bantu languages, the root NTU tied personhood to breath and existence. Even in daily speech, identity was spiritual. Colonization attempted to silence this vast chorus. European languages, English, French, Portuguese, Dutch, and Spanish, became the official tongues of governance, education, and religion. Generations were raised to see their mother tongues as backward. But the tongues never died. They waited. Colonial erasure and the language of power. The imposition of colonial languages wasn't accidental, it was strategic. Colonial powers understood that to erase a people's language was to erase their worldview and replace it with their own. Missionaries translated the Bible into local languages, but simultaneously dismantled traditional belief systems. Colonial administrators enforced European languages in schools. Children were punished for speaking their native tongue. The consequence? A generation that could recite Shakespeare, but not the proverbs of their own ancestors. Language became a battleground, not just of pronunciation, but of identity. Even the word Africa itself replaced names like Alcabulan, Kush, Kemet, and Ifriqiya. The continent became a map defined by foreign labels. Sudan from Bilad al-Sudan, Nigeria from the River Niger, Rhodesia from a British businessman's name. In the space of a century, entire civilizations were renamed. But names carry power, and the fight to reclaim them has never ended. The return of Olkabulan, more than a word. In the mid-20th century, as independence movements swept across Olkabulan, a new word began to surface in Pan-African circles, Olkabulan. To some, it was believed to be the original name of the continent, used by early scholars, Moors, or native civilizations long before Rome imposed Africa. Others saw it as a symbolic name, one that reconnected the continent to its forgotten majesty. Regardless of its etymological roots, the name Olkabulan has taken on deeper meaning, a restoration of dignity. Today, you'll find the word not just in textbooks or speeches, but in street murals, festivals, fashion lines, music lyrics, and restaurant menus. It's spoken with reverence and pride. It signals a shift in consciousness. It says, "We existed before colonization, and we are more than what was done to us." Pan-Africanism, from resistance to reconnection. Pan-Africanism is more than a political idea. It's a linguistic and spiritual movement. Born in the late 19th century in the diaspora, among scholars, activists, and freed slaves, Pan-Africanism sought to unify people of African descent worldwide. Its early thinkers included Henry Sylvester Williams, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Marcus Garvey, who called for Africa for the Africans. Later leaders like Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, and Julius Nyerere carried the torch into political independence. But Pan-Africanism was also about culture, about reclaiming names, histories, and voices. Kwame Nkrumah named his new country Ghana after a medieval West African empire. Sekou Touré of Guinea rejected French control, saying, "We prefer poverty and freedom to riches in slavery." In Tanzania, Nyerere promoted Ujamaa, a blend of African socialism and traditional values rooted in Swahili language. Pan-Africanists saw language as liberation. Nkrumah emphasized teaching local languages. Leopold Senghor, poet president of Senegal, celebrated negritude, the beauty of black identity expressed in French and Wolof alike. Today, the Pan-African flag, red, black, and green, is flown not just by governments, but by hip-hop artists, university students, and protesters. Its colors have become a visual language, and its words, unity, pride, liberation, echo across borders. the language of reclamation. Reclaiming language is more than vocabulary. It's spiritual resistance. In South Africa, the Black Consciousness Movement led by Steve Biko emphasized decolonizing the mind. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor, Biko said, is the mind of the oppressed. Language in this context was either a chain or a key. In Kenya, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, once a celebrated English language novelist, chose to write in Kikuyu. He was imprisoned for doing so. Today, he's a global icon of linguistic resistance. In Ethiopia, Amharic remains a national language rooted in script and tradition. In Rwanda, Kinyarwanda is taught alongside French and English, restoring local identity. And in countries like Senegal, Ghana, and Tanzania, indigenous languages are being incorporated into school systems, art, and media. Even outside the continent, African Americans are reclaiming Swahili through Afrocentric movements like Kwanzaa. Caribbean communities explore Yoruba and Akan, names through spiritual traditions like Santeria and Vodou. Each reclaimed word is a small revolution. Language, music, and code switching. In today's Alkabulan, most people are multilingual. A Ghanaian might speak Twi at home, English at school, and Pidgin with friends. A Kenyan might blend Swahili, Kikuyu, and Sheng, a Nairobi slang that mixes local and global influences. Code switching is an art form, moving between worlds, adapting registers, carrying identity in shifting tones. In music, language is liberation. From Fela Kuti's fusion of Yoruba, English, and Pidgin, to Burna Boy's Afrofusion, to Angelique Kidjo's multilingual ballads, African artists are turning language into rhythm, resistance, and rebirth. The rise of Afrobeats and Amapiano on global stages is more than entertainment. It's a reclamation of sound, space, and story. When a young artist raps in Wolof, or Shona, or Ewe, they're not just making music, they're making memory. Diaspora reconnection, language as bridge. The transatlantic slave trade scattered the children of Alkabulan across the globe, but the language of connection survived. In Brazil, Yoruba survives in the chants of Candomblé. In Haiti, Creole blends French with West African syntax and tone. In Louisiana, Creole carries memories of Dahomey, Congo, and Mandinka. In Jamaica, Patois uses rhythm and metaphor that echo ancestral speech. Diaspora communities are now reconnecting with the continent, not just through DNA tests, but through language learning, cultural immersion, and spiritual return. Apps teach Twi, Igbo, and Swahili. TikTok creators break down African slang. Podcasts and poetry reintroduce words that once crossed oceans in silence. Language is the bridge back home. The power of naming. Names carry spells. They shape how we see the world and how the world sees us. Across Alkabulan, names have meaning. A child named Makena in Kenya brings happiness. A boy named Kwame in Ghana was born on a Saturday. A girl named Esha carries life. These names are not random. They are prayers, prophecies, and history. Colonial systems tried to replace these with Christian and European names. But the revival is growing. More parents are reclaiming indigenous names for their children. Artists, activists, and public figures are dropping European names and embracing African ones. Even cities and nations have joined the wave. Leopoldville became Kinshasa. Salisbury became Harare. Gold Coast became Ghana. Every reclaimed name is an act of defiance. Every word spoken in a native tongue is an affirmation. Every syllable matters. Because Language is not just how we speak. It's how we remember and how we return. Chapter 7. Rebirth and the Future. What does it mean to reclaim a name that was almost forgotten? To speak Alcabulan is not just to remember a word. It is to awaken a worldview, to rewrite a history long distorted, and to step forward with the full weight of ancestral wisdom behind you. In this final chapter, we step into the present and the future, a time where Alcabulan is no longer just the name of a lost past. It is the compass of a rebirth. Across oceans, a scattered people return. Across Harlem, Johannesburg, Accra, London, Kingston, and Atlanta, the spirit of Alcabulan rises not from ruins, but from rhythm, art, and reimagined identity. Young designers in Lagos blend traditional Kente and Ankara patterns with modern silhouettes. Visual artists in Nairobi rework colonial-era maps, replacing borders with rivers and ancestral symbols. In Barbados and Brazil, diaspora scholars gather to decode the suppressed stories of the transatlantic passage and to find themselves in the mirror of Alcabulan. Cultural festivals named after Alcabulan now bring together chefs, poets, musicians, and healers from across the global black world. They are not just celebrations, they are reunions. In these spaces, children wear names like Zuberi, Ayana, and Obi with pride. Elders are called Griot and Nia instead of Grandpa and Auntie. Drums echo. Ancestors are honored. The future is called by its name, and it answers. Urban Africa reimagines itself. Cities in Alcabulan are no longer only defined by poverty or post-colonial struggle. They are alive with innovation and rooted pride. In Kigali, Rwanda's capital, clean streets, eco-design, and digital infrastructure point to what a post-conflict, self-directed African future can look like. In Ghana, the Year of Return initiative welcomed thousands of African Americans back to the continent, not as tourists, but as kin. Some bought land, others traced genealogy, all touched soil that pulsed with memory. In Ethiopia, modern light rail glides past Orthodox churches and bustling teff markets. In Senegal, the African Renaissance Monument, taller than the Statue of Liberty, rises defiantly, a bronze family facing the future with arms stretched wide. Africa is not rising. It has risen. It was never asleep, just silenced. Now, the cities of Alcabulan buzz with film collectives, tech startups, organic farms, digital Pan-African think tanks, and spiritual wellness hubs. It's not just a movement, it's a renaissance. Climate, land, and the return to harmony. Yet this rebirth comes with responsibility. Climate change, deforestation, and industrial exploitation threaten Alcabulan's sacred relationship with the land. But here, too, the ancestral ways offer answers. In Zimbabwe, agroecologists revive ancient farming techniques, like zai pits and chitamene systems that conserve water and soil. In Kenya, the Green Belt Movement, founded by Wangari Maathai, continues to reforest degraded land and empower women to protect their environment. Traditional ecological knowledge, once dismissed, is now being repurposed for resilience. Local wisdom about rainfall, crop cycles, and animal migration is being validated by data. Villages return to permaculture and indigenous seed saving. Youth-led green initiatives blend solar tech with tribal knowledge. Nomadic groups like the Tuareg and Fulani are being consulted on adaptive survival strategies. The land is speaking again, and this time, people are listening. the rise of Afrocentric education. Across the continent and diaspora, there is a movement to reclaim education, not just in curriculum, but in philosophy. From Nairobi to Baltimore, schools and homeschooling programs teach black children not only math and science, but self. They learn about Nubia, Benin, and Dahomey, not as side notes, but as central chapters in global civilization. Books like The Destruction of Black Civilization, African Origins of Civilization, and Decolonizing the Mind have become required reading in alternative classrooms. Students debate Ma'at and Ubuntu alongside Socrates and Locke. They recite proverbs from Igbo and Xhosa, traditions alongside Shakespeare and Baldwin. Digital platforms allow students in Jamaica to attend virtual Swahili classes taught by instructors in Kenya. Podcasts, YouTube series, and e-books are translating ancestral wisdom into modern formats. Education is no longer about assimilation, it's about reorientation. Alcabulan is not being remembered, it's being relearned. Technology with ancestral roots. Technology, once a tool of exploitation, is now being repurposed as a tool for reconnection. African technologists are coding in Yoruba and Zulu. Language apps teach endangered tongues. Startups use blockchain to track indigenous seed exchanges and protect land rights. Artificial intelligence is being trained on oral histories. Virtual reality is used to walk through pre-colonial cities. Ancestral DNA mapping connects African Americans to regions like Togo, Sierra Leone, or the Congo Basin, not as abstractions, but as living, breathing places. Young developers are building digital griots, AI-driven storytelling bots that carry proverbs, myths, and prayers from tribal libraries into digital eternity. This is not nostalgia. This is futuristic remembering. Spiritual return. Not religion, but rhythm. In Harlem, a young woman lights candles and offers honey to Oshun. In Cape Town, a Sangoma performs a ritual that her ancestors practiced beneath the stars. In Oakland, a man pours libation to the ancestors before a community meeting. These are not isolated acts. They are fragments of a returning spiritual rhythm, one that doesn't ask for conversion, but reconnection. Whether through Orisha, Vodun, Ubuntu, Ma'at, or personal intuition, more people of African descent are seeking to align their souls with ancestral vibration. This movement isn't anti-modern. It's post-colonial and post-dogma. It doesn't require temples. Only intention. It doesn't erase other faiths. It simply opens space for home to be a part of the spiritual journey again. Alcabulan, in this sense, becomes a spiritual compass, pointing not to one God, but to a web of relationship, rhythm, reverence, and respect. Naming the future. What is next for Alcabulan? The answer is already unfolding in a thousand quiet ways. In the reclaiming of indigenous names for children born in Toronto, Dakar, and Amsterdam. In the creation of films, books, and songs that center black imagination outside the framework of pain. In the farmers' markets where ancient grains like fonio, teff, and millet are making a comeback. In the tech labs of Nairobi, the poetry lounges of Kampala, the fashion streets of Johannesburg, and the diasporic kitchen tables of Trinidad. The future of Alcabulan is not about going backward. It's about pulling the past forward, reshaping it, repurposing it, and letting it guide the way. It is not about uniformity. Alcabulan was always plural. It speaks in thousands of languages. It dances in hundreds of rhythms. Its power lies in its diversity, unified not by borders, but by memory. The final circle. We began with a word, Alcabulan, a word that once echoed across ancient cities and now rises again on tongues that had long been forced to forget. What does it mean to speak that word today? It means reclaiming story over stereotype. It means living in rhythm with the land and spirit. It means teaching our children where they come from so they can know where they're going. This is not the end of the story. This is the return to Alcabulan, to balance, to ourselves.